From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Washington Post this week published the first three installments of an ongoing series about top secret America, its name for the shadowy, disconnected intelligence apparatus that has ballooned in size, scope, and funding since the attacks of September 11, 2001. The authors are the Post's Dana Priest and military and intelligence analyst William Arkin. The premise is that no one, not even those at the highest levels of government, has a clear picture of who's doing what in American intelligence. Some of the Post's findings? There are 1,271 government organizations and 1,931 private companies working on counterterrorism, homeland security, and intelligence, and an estimated 854,000 people who have top secret security clearances. Arkin says the two-year-long project was, in a word, daunting.
We thought to ourselves, how in the hell are we going to be able to figure out what is the totality of what has transpired since 9/11? And the way in which we thought about it was anything, whether it's warrantless surveillance or the most innocuous program, has to be located somewhere, and we set about the process of figuring that out. Then we were able to start analyzing the data to look for patterns or significant new facts. And I would say that there are basically three that we discovered. One was the number of new organizations and new companies which have been created since 9/11. Two was the domination of information technology in this new industry. And number three, this is an industry which has transformed itself from one which is primarily in the public sector to one that is increasingly in the private sector.
You estimate that about 30% of the people with top security clearances are private contractors. Are they harder to keep track of? Do they conform to the same rules that govern government officials?
After 9/11, there was a sense that there needed to be an enormous and quick surge of American capability. They had to go to the private sector, and so you have profit-making companies who have no incentive to cooperate with other companies and no incentive not to make more money, and unregulated bureaucrats are not going to ever volunteer to cut themselves.
So there's no comprehensive watchdog over this Hydra-headed beast?
There really isn't, Brooke. I have to say to you that one of the things that stunned us as we were talking to people inside the government was we would say, we've put together this list of 85 entities within the Department of Justice that are doing various aspects of intelligence. And people in government would say, really? Can I see that list? I even remember an occasion in which we made a presentation and someone in the room said, the Internal Revenue Service, it doesn't do top secret work. And we showed them what the top secret work that the Internal Revenue Service did. And this government person sort of slumped in their chair and said, oh, I guess so.
Now, it seems no one has a handle on this top secret America, except perhaps you. And yet you say all this information, this entire database, was built on public records. If this is all so top secret, how is it that all that information was out there?
Look, everything lives somewhere. Everything has some footprint. Everything has some exhaust. And we were able to, using really the methods of U.S. intelligence, if you will, to map this out. But in the end, we held that the standard for including something in the database was that we had to have a public record associated with it and we had to have a confirmation.
Do you think it would have been possible to assemble and present this volume of data before these online tools were available?
You know, it couldn't have been done without the digital side. And in the time period that the Washington Post supported this two-year project, Brooke, they consolidated the digital and print newsrooms. So now all of the people who work at the Washington Post, both online and on paper, work in the same building, on the same newsroom, in the same floor. And I think that this is the product of what that consolidation has meant. And I think it's a pointer of what's possible when one conceives of a project digitally from the beginning.
What did Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and CIA Chief Leon Panetta and General Clapper, the soon-to-be Director of National Intelligence, think of this piece?
You know, when we spoke to Secretary Gates, he said, "I wish I could find out how many contractors work for my own office, but I haven't been able to do so. Some people have said to us, hooray, go on, do more. Other people, particularly people in the security and counterintelligence world, were alarmed and thought that we were endangering national security. The reality is that after much consideration, much legal counsel, the government could not provide us with any specifics as to what about this was really bothering them."
They didn't give you a specific objection. But did it give you pause that clarifying this complex web might be helping people who would want to harm the country?
Well, Brooke, I've heard these arguments many times before. In 1983, I revealed where all of the nuclear weapons sites around the world were. And the Reagan administration at the time not only threatened me with jail, but said that, you know, this would jeopardize the security of nuclear weapons. And I don't think it had that impact at all. In fact, the transparency was responsible for much disarmament at the time. But, you know, with an institution like the Washington Post, I am not the person making the decisions. Many revisions were made to the mapping application and the database in order to strike a balance. In the end, I'm really satisfied that we've presented something that is in the public interest with the greatest care in order to preserve national security and public safety at the same time.
Do you think that the Director of National Intelligence, the Secretary of Defense, and the head of the CIA will use your database to help solve some of the problems that the database reveals?
Yes, I think they will, and I think Congress will as well. And in this world of transparency and digital monitoring, I can already tell you how many people from those government agencies are looking at the database every day.
How many?
A lot.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill Arkin is a military and intelligence analyst with The Washington Post. Last year, The Wall Street Journal's Siobhan Gorman reported that U.S. security officials believe that Chinese and Russian cyber spies had not only hacked into the computer systems that run our electrical grid, but left behind malicious software that could be activated at any time. In military terms, that's called preparing the battlefield for some potential future war. Fast forward more than a year, and Gorman has now discovered what we're doing about it. She recently wrote in the journal about a hush-hush program called Perfect Citizen, designed to, quote, detect cyber assaults on private companies and government agencies. The program is to be governed by the National Security Agency, which does not exactly have a stellar record when it comes to balancing global threats and personal privacy. It's awarded defense contractor Raytheon, yes, another private company, a contract to develop ways to monitor our critical computer systems. And Gorman says we're not just talking about the electrical grid anymore.
Nuclear power plants, air traffic control systems, most cities' subways are also run by these computerized systems as well.
You quote an internal Raytheon email in which an employee likens the program to Big Brother. In fact, he or she says, quote, Perfect Citizen is Big Brother. Does that concern you?
Well, I did find it interesting. I mean, usually people who are working on these types of projects are very committed to national security and, while maybe taking privacy into account, usually feel that it's being dealt with as part of the program. So I thought that that was a very revealing email in that it showed that people with very insider knowledge still don't necessarily feel the privacy concerns are being addressed.
What sorts of information would the government be sorting through via Raytheon?
It would most likely be looking for what are called anomalies in internet traffic. So say you saw all of a sudden a lot of data flowing to some sort of computer system that was outside the norm. In theory, Perfect Citizen would pick that up and then do further digging to try to figure out, well, is it because somebody's trying to steal data out of this system?
So if what you've heard of this program involves just looking for anomalies, the kinds of things that private companies handle, our private information, our medical records, our financial records, and so forth, wouldn't be tripping those alarms, So why is somebody inside calling this Big Brother?
Some people feel that programs like that are sort of the first step down the road to government collection on lots of other elements of the private sector. One potential concern about safeguards is, well, where is it that NSA would be getting this data? Would it be collecting it directly from the companies, or would there be multiple steps through which the company would actually vet the data that is ultimately provided to NSA, and who's actually controlling the flow of that information?
Many of us were concerned when we found out that the NSA was in a position to data mine telephone calls and our internet use. Then they had some agreement with Google to look at some of that information. How does this expand the reach that the NSA already has?
Well, generally, the NSA has focused on looking for these types of things overseas and has not been in the domestic arena, particularly when it comes to trying to protect U.S. computer systems. And the challenge that U.S. government officials have run into repeatedly is that when NSA is tracking anything on the internet, the difference in terms of what you need to do to look for potential cyber attacks and what you need to do to read somebody's email is not really all that different from a technical standpoint. And so I think that people get concerned if there aren't safeguards put in place that would prevent the government from making that move from just monitoring for bad stuff on the internet to monitoring all stuff on the internet.
What's the status of this program as far as you know?
It's really just in the beginning stages. My understanding is that the first set of funding is for what they're calling phase one, and that's probably going to be somewhere from $50 to $100 million. But then that, of course, implies that there would be subsequent phases where they would probably be truly implementing these things. Oftentimes, phase one just means kind of a designing phase to really figure out what the program is going to look like.
I have to ask you about the name, which, let's be honest, couldn't be creepier. Perfect citizen? It just sounds like people spying on one another.
Many people raised that issue with me, and I think that that is also what may have raised some people's concerns about what the true intent or perhaps what the ultimate intent of the program is.
Siobhan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Siobhan Gorman is the National Intelligence Correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. You might think that public documents would be, well, public. That is, accessible and for the most part free. But in fact, though many non-classified government documents and videos are technically available, they are neither free nor easy to procure. Enter the crusading Carl Malamud, who's spent the better part of the past two decades provoking, coercing, persuading the government to make its public workings truly public. He's currently president of public.resource.org. Carl, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Brooke.
So you actually get things done, partly because you're a crusader and all that that implies, and partly because you know what you're doing. So let's start with the first part. What sent you on this quest?
It was actually very personal at first because I was writing professional reference books about networks, and it cost me tens of thousands of dollars to buy the technical specifications underlying some of these networks that were out there. And that just offended me personally that I couldn't download these international standards and just read them.
So it began with the fact that you were being blocked, but then you ventured into whole swaths of blocked information that are supposed to be public, everything from financial disclosures from corporations to laws.
Yeah, it was sort of an accident. I was running the first radio station on the internet in the early 90s. My flagship program was called Geek of the Week, and we were doing a demo before the United States Congress, and Congressman Markey came up and wanted to know why the Securities and Exchange Commission database called EDGAR wasn't available on the internet. And at the time, it cost $30 to buy one of these public reports that corporations filed with the SEC. And I looked at the database for the congressman and said, well, you know, technically, there's really no reason why this shouldn't be available. So I got lucky. I actually got the National Science Foundation to give me taxpayer money to buy taxpayer data to put on the internet to give away to taxpayers for free.
You put documents online in a cheap and accessible way. The SEC itself said essentially that it couldn't be done.
They didn't say it couldn't be done. They said it would cost a lot of money.
$30 million.
Yeah, it would cost $30 million. And more importantly, it would destroy our system of free enterprise because there were companies out there making a lot of money selling these documents.
So how did you convince them otherwise?
pretty soon 50,000 people a day were using our database, and that conclusively demonstrated that there was a demand for this. And the demand was senior citizen investment clubs, and it was journalists, and it was students, and it was people that otherwise couldn't get access to this data. And then the last obstacle was his computer people said, well, gee, you know, we'd love to do it, but, you know, it'll take us 2-3 years. And so we put a bunch of workstations and servers in the back of a station wagon and drove them down to the Security and Exchange Commission and got their internet line up and running. And at that point, there were no excuses, and they were in the business.
You also did battle with C-SPAN, that few would regard as an enemy of disclosure, but it was rather tight-fisted with its own little domain.
C-SPAN is a wonderful nonprofit, and they were putting congressional hearings online, and they just felt that they had copyright in all this material. And they sent a takedown notice to the Speaker of the House telling her to take down a YouTube clip of herself testifying before the Congress. And that seemed to me to be a little bit of overreaching. I sent a public letter to Brian Lamb that said, hey, you know, this is nuts. And to C-SPAN's credit, this was several years ago, they looked at the situation and they changed their policies so that anybody can use any of their government material as long as it's for non-commercial purposes.
You've also drawn swords with the federal court's online document service called PACER. Explain what you had against PACER.
They have a system which, you know, to be fair, Congress told them to do this, in which they charge 8 cents a page. They had a public access program for a little while, and we managed to use that to grab about 20 million pages of PACER documents. If I had purchased those documents at 8 cents per page, it would have been $1.5 million. The only people who can afford them are the big data mining companies, right? The credit reporting companies that are mining these documents for Social Security numbers.
But let's talk about regular people who might want to use PACER to get some documents. I mean, is the cost so onerous?
Yeah, actually, I know a young lady who ran up a $30,000 bill investigating her landlord. But even more importantly, we did a survey of 66 law schools, and 63 of them don't let the law students access the PACER system because it costs money. The Department of Justice spends $4 million a year they have to pay in order to access these trial court databases. Journalists, if you want to do a real investigation of court cases, you're going to have to go to your editor and say, hey, I'm going to run up a few hundred dollars in bills.
You've had a lot of resistance from what's called the legal information industry.
Well, the legal information industry is a $10 billion a year industry with companies such as Westlaw and LexisNexis and W.S. Hine. And they mainly sell legal information to working lawyers. And it's a big business. So I am fine with a company taking a court case and having their lawyers analyze it and tell you what the significant points of law are and selling that. But the core information needs to be available. And we've gotten ourselves into a situation in which the only way to read the official reports is to go to some company that has been designated as the official reporter. And that's wrong, right? There's a court decision known as the Vec decision says if it's the law, then there's no copyright, right? If people have to obey the law and have to read it and there's criminal penalties, then you can't say it's copyrighted. But despite that, the building, electrical, fire, all the public safety codes have very firm copyright assertions.
So now you're launching a new project called law.gov.
Law.gov is an idea that every governmental body should make their laws available so that other groups such as Westlaw and LexisNexis, but also nonprofits and universities and internet startups can download what I call America's operating system, right? The rules that govern our society.
You're truly a geek to call this America's operating system.
But, you know, the analogy does hold because these are the technical regulations about how we live our lives. So law.gov, we held workshops and looked at all these issues. We looked at what about privacy? What about technical standards for how to make this information more broadly available? And did a very in-depth examination with many of the leading scholars in the field. And the hope is that we can distill this and then present it to the Judicial Conference and the President and the Congress and say, you know, there ought to be a law, and the law says that the law ought to be more widely available. And so charging for PACER documents, no different than a poll tax, right? Charging for access to the polls denies equal protection under the law. Charging for access to the law denies equal protection under the law.
So you plan to take this to Congress and to the White House. The Obama administration has made a public avowal of transparency being a priority. it isn't always in practice in this White House. What do you anticipate Obama's reaction will be?
My basic assumption is that if we can lay out a broad consensus and say, look, all the law schools and the industry and public officials have all participated in this process, and we all agree that the law needs to be more broadly available, we think President Obama, being a constitutional scholar, will take about 30 seconds to get this.
Carl, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Carl Malamud is the president of public.resource.org. In February of this year, a top government official from Cambodia wrote a letter to Google complaining about one of the company's maps. The letter claimed that Google's depiction of a stretch of border between Cambodia and Thailand was, quote, devoid of truth and reality and professionally irresponsible. Cambodia requested that Google, quote, withdraw the already disseminated very wrong and not internationally recognized map and replace it. As editor John Gravois points out in the July-August issue of The Washington Monthly, 21st century map making can be politically thorny and culturally fraught. His piece is titled The Agnostic Cartographer. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Tell me about the state of Arunachal Pradesh in the far northeast of India and what Google did to it one day last August.
Well, Arunachal Pradesh has been a source of pretty nasty dispute between China and India since 1914, when the British rulers of India negotiated a treaty with Tibet, which was at the time de facto independent. So China now, which runs Tibet, doesn't acknowledge that agreement that established Arunachal Pradesh as an Indian state.
So what did Google do to it?
So last August, a weekday, everything's quiet on the internet. And then suddenly, Google Maps changes all the place names in Arunachal Pradesh into Chinese.
Now, how did this happen?
It's a mystery. A lot of angry Indian bloggers suspected immediately that Google and China were conspiring together. Others suspected that Chinese hackers broke in and changed the names in the database. But a blogger by the name of Stefan Gienz, who runs a wonderful site that keeps track of border disputes in the age of Google Earth, came up with another theory. He pointed out that Google maintains a separate map site for China and a separate map site for India. According to Chinese law, all maps have to represent what the Indians call Arunachal Pradesh as South Tibet. Stefan Gienz, this blogger, posited that the names on the Chinese map must have somehow switched over into the names on the global map that we all look at.
Let's go back to the golden era of map making during the European colonial era of the 1800s. What was the philosophy then, so to speak, behind cartography?
The whole map-making enterprise supported the expansion of European powers out into unfamiliar territory. Map-making was also something that came under this sort of industrial era, progressive-minded idea that everything can be measured, the world can be indexed, we can narrow down to a clear account of pretty much everything. The colonial era came crashing to an end, and with that, map-making changed. A geographer I spoke to named Michael Goodchild, he described this historical process where modernist state-run data collection efforts went by the wayside gradually. Satellites started to take their place.
Let's talk about satellites. Obviously, you can get a much more accurate picture of the world, but as you note, there's a lot that we can't get from satellites. That's where Google comes in with its MapMaker tool, which any person can use. How does it work?
Google has set up a pretty straightforward, user-friendly platform called Google MapMaker that allows people in hitherto unmapped parts of the world to just enter in information about the place where they live. There's also a thing called the community layer of Google Earth, which is just like a bulletin board that's tagged to a map. And in Israel, a Palestinian user of Google Earth was going around and tagging different towns as what he said were the sites of former Palestinian villages destroyed in the 1948 creation of Israel. And he tagged a town called Kiryat Yam as one of those villages. The people in Kiryat Yam were very upset by this. They said, in fact, our town was founded on barren sand dunes, and you've basically slandered us.
Another Google-fueled cartographic controversy is over what to call that body of water between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula.
For years and years and years and years, that body of water has been known as the Persian Gulf. But in the 1960s, there was a movement in Arab countries to call it the Arabian Gulf. This arose with Arab nationalism and was promoted by Saddam Hussein, among many, many other people.
And obviously, Persia is a reference to Iran, which is not an Arabic nation. And Iran took this very personally.
That's putting it lightly. It's been a big dispute for decades now. In 2004, National Geographic issued a new edition of its main atlas and included the name Arabian Gulf as an alternate name in parentheses and small print. The Iranians staged huge email campaigns, letter-writing campaigns, street protests. In Iran itself, all National Geographic products were banned, boycotted. And at the time, one of the largest Google bombs to date was created in response to it as well, where if you searched for the term Arabian Gulf on Google, the top result was a website that looked like an error message that said, "I'm sorry, the Gulf you're looking for doesn't exist. Please try Persian Gulf."
Now, Google took the National Geographic route, essentially, didn't it? By listing both names.
Yes. On Google Earth, if you go to the Gulf, you'll see in equal-sized text, Persian Gulf near Iran and Arabian Gulf near Qatar and Bahrain and the UAE and Saudi Arabia. So Google isn't taking the National Geographic route in one respect, which is that it's not backing down.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the largest online petitions on the internet today is a petition that demands the immediate and unconditional deletion of Arabian Gulf from Google Earth. And what's interesting about the petition is that it attacks Google for not adhering to the standards of cartography that might have been espoused by 19th century mapmakers. The Iranian petition accuses Google of not obeying international standards. Google's response was really interesting. A couple months after the petition went live, they posted a kind of statement about how they decide what to name things. And the statement made no mention of history, made no mention of international standards. They just said, "We name bodies of water according to the names that countries adjoining that body of water use." There's no science except for the science of just finding out what people say.
So what do you think about Google's repudiation of history and tradition?
Well, it follows a pretty standard kind of philosophy of the internet era, which is, you know, the more information, the better. The more democratic the production of information, the better. But Google gets itself into trouble. Google is now producing the world's most important map that used to be something nation states did. And what's happening in all these geographic disputes is that Google's getting confused with a nation state, and not just anyone, a really important one, a powerful one. In all of these conflicts, you see parties to these disputes accuse Google of being geopolitical conspirators. The whole time, Google is kind of shrugging and saying, "We're showing as many claims as possible, trying to be neutral."
This is what people are calling neo-geography, where we can layer our maps with all kinds of information. Doesn't that raise the question, what is it we want our maps to be now, if no longer a single authoritative view of the world?
It's almost like we shouldn't use the word map anymore. It's a completely different thing. It's a completely rescalable document that can hold authoritative information, but it can also have other layers of information that are just sort of repositories of a bunch of different opinions or even conversations. That's neat, and it may play a really huge, valuable social role in the future. But the process of adjusting to that new norm is going to be really, really hairy.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Gravois is an editor at The Washington Monthly. Broadcast veteran Daniel Shore died this week at the age of 93. Over the 5 years I was senior editor of Weekend Edition with Scott Simon and later All Things Considered, I was often his editor. When he yelled at me, I felt like I had arrived. I sat across from him a dozen times as Scott's fill-in host. When he made fun of me, I felt like part of broadcasting history. Because that's what Dan was, a courageous, cranky monument to a courageous, cranky business. When business is good. As public radio listeners, you will have heard the highlights of Dan's history by now, opening CBS's Moscow Bureau, making Nixon's enemies list, earning his first $5 as a reporter in 1928 at age 12 when he saw the body of a woman fall from the roof of his apartment building and called the Bronx Home News. But he was no stone monument. He knew self-importance was an occupational hazard, so he was glad to punch holes in it. That's why we'll celebrate him with this. When CNN's Anderson Cooper was rumored to be developing his own cologne, called Coop, we dreamed up an ad of our own.
The sounds of your life captivate you.
For the regime that was denounced by President Bush to be able to summon the superpower to the conference table is clearly a feather in the cap of the Tehran government. But surely there must be something more involved in this unusual flirtation.
Daniel.
Hear me.
Daniel.
Smell me.
Daniel. Shaw, an incisive fragrance from news analyst Daniel Shaw. At fine retailers everywhere.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Monday, Georgia USDA official Shirley Sherrod was depicted on a conservative blog as a racist in an out-of-context video clip of a speech she delivered to the NAACP. She was describing how, 24 years ago, she considered withholding her help from a white farmer because so many black farmers had suffered without it. That's where the tape essentially ended. That day, the Department of Agriculture fired her. That night, the NAACP condemned her. But the unedited tape showed her explaining how she had looked into her heart and saw that the poor of all races deserved her help. The white farmer in question stepped forward to defend her, declaring she had saved his farm. Tuesday, NAACP Chief Ben Jealous apologized.
Sometimes we make a mistake. And we made one here.
Wednesday, the government apologized and tried to rehire her. Here's Press Secretary Robert Gibbs.
Without a doubt, Ms. Sherrod is owed an apology. I would do so certainly on behalf of this administration.
Initially, of course, Fox played up the story. A wide array of Fox News talking heads, including Laura Ingraham, condemned her and everyone else.
Where was the NAACP? And frankly, where was the media on this story? Was anyone covering this?
And then Fox News special report host Brett Baer, while not apologizing, disavowed any knowledge of Fox's actions.
Fox News didn't even do the story. We didn't do it on special report.
Andrew Breitbart, whose blog was the source of the incriminating tape, says he never condemned Sherrod. Only the NAACP. They forced him to do it.
I'm invested in getting the NAACP and the Democratic Party and the Congressional Black Caucus to stop constantly calling the Tea Party racist. That's my job. Mm-hmm. I could care less about Shirley Sherrod.
Okay. Maybe we haven't yet developed the reflexes to cope with this new era of unbounded media. This is, after all, an era where everyone can publish with no regard for 20th century rules of journalism. As when in the earliest days of our republic, the Connecticut Courant could accuse Thomas Jefferson of robbing widows. Back then, citizens gorged themselves on newspapers of all stripes, and they gave them the respect they deserved, which is to say, not much. They would have hooted when NAACP's Ben Jealous said,
"You know, we're forced in this line of work to make quick judgments about video evidence and video testimony all the time. You know, we made a mistake here."
Nobody is forcing him or the White House or any one of us to do anything. How many teachable moments in modern media are required before we learn to sniff before we swallow? 18th century American news consumers would have had two words for us, caveat emptor. Or make those three words, consider the source. Consider, for example, Andrew Breitbart. When Politico reported that Tea Party protesters hurled racial slurs at black legislators after the passage of the health care bill, Breitbart refused to believe it. He countered with a joke posted to his Twitter account. Quote, "Oh my God, the Dems are screaming the N-word outside my house. I swear. No, really. Trust me." Is he forcing you to trust him? Come on. Not even Breitbart expects you to trust him. We've all heard of the Hollywood 10, the movie industry's blacklist instigated from the top down by Senator Joe McCarthy, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and the predations of J. Edgar Hoover. Back in 2007, we spoke to David Everett about his book, A Shadow of Red, Communism and the Blacklist in Radio and Television. Unlike the movie industry purge, the broadcast blacklist was a bottom-up grassroots affair launched principally by five men. Three were ex-FBI agents, one a former military intelligence officer, and one a grocer from Syracuse. 60 years ago this summer, with the Korean War on the horizon, the ex-agents published a booklet called Red Channels, which listed 151 suspected communist sympathizers in broadcasting, some famous and some not. But as Everett notes, for Red Hunters, rooting out famous infiltrators was less important because even the lowliest communist posed a threat.
Someone once asked them, what possible harm can there be if there was a communist sympathizer who was the third violinist in a studio orchestra? And the answer that they came up with is, well, the third violinist, he sits next to the first violinist and he knows the engineer and he knows an announcer, perhaps. So, in effect, anyone can be a possible security risk.
And so you have these three FBI agents in their newsletter called Counterattack and their magazine called Red Channels, where they list these people, mostly based in New York, who are members of communist front organizations that seem to champion good liberal causes like international peace, civil rights, workplace protections.
Of course, in the larger picture, as we know now, communists weren't just in favor of unemployment insurance and civil rights. The Communist Party was involved in facilitating espionage in this country. And also what was going on is they were raising money for communist causes.
So you have this former naval intelligence officer scouting these people out. You have the grocer in Syracuse, New York, putting pressure on advertisers and through them the networks. How did the networks react?
Yeah, well, CBS, which was considered to be the most liberal network and as a result really became the first target of blacklisters, they caved in very quickly, instituted a loyalty oath. NBC, there were people who were blacklisted from their shows, but there were other people who might have been blacklisted but continued to work. Then at ABC, very early on, Gypsy Rose Lee, she had a talk show at the time, became the target of American Legionnaires who made certain charges against her. And ABC's response was, let's see the proof that you have for these charges. And then American Legionnaires essentially said, well, we just got it from Red Channels. You should really talk to them. Each person passed the buck. The net result was that she was not blacklisted. So there is a case of a network standing up to blacklisters, and they were able to get away with it.
It seemed that the consequences depended on how big a star you were. A relatively minor actress like Jean Muir could have her whole professional life disrupted, whereas Lucille Ball was another matter.
That gets to something that I thought was very important while I was researching this book. Obviously, anti-communists, no matter how zealous they are, have the right to talk about who might be a communist. But what gave them their true power was the fact that broadcasters, in effect, gave them their power, that they panicked. And when it came to people who were not that important, that often meant writers because they didn't really care about them at all, they would just immediately go ahead and get them off the airwaves. But then suddenly there was some information about Lucille Ball having some connection to the Communist Party going back to 1936. Suddenly, CBS developed a backbone, and they stood up to the charges, and nothing happened. There were no consequences.
So all of this is going on behind the scenes. How is it playing out on the small screen or on the radio?
You did hear, for instance, a radio show which was called I Was a Communist for the FBI.
Many of the incidents in the story you're about to hear are based on the actual records and authentic experiences of Matt Savetic, who for 9 fantastic years lived as a communist for the FBI.
As you can pretty much gather from the title, it was quite an alarmist show.
Was there any fighting back on the radio?
Actually, on TV, there was one show called You Are There, which actually involved the use of several blacklisted writers who were working on the show through fronts, people who would lend their names to the scripts of blacklisted writers. This was a show which recreated historical events and made it seem like they were news reports unfolding before the viewer's eyes.
Salem, Massachusetts, June 1692. CBS is there.
They very often would do stories which were clearly political parables. They did one about the trial of Galileo. They did one about the Salem witch trials. These parables got a lot of attention amongst certain people, but I think if you look at them now, they really don't come across as well. They came across as really stodgy recitations.
This morning, a prosecution witness, the Reverend Mr. Samuel Parris, minister of Salem Village, testified that the alleged unnatural activities of Rebecca Norse are actually part of a much larger plot against the government.
The blacklist effectively ended in broadcasting because of a lawsuit brought by a frustrated radio personality named John Henry Falk.
Yeah, he was someone who was known as a professional Texan radio personality, a raconteur who appeared on CBS Radio. He was blacklisted in 1957. And what he did, unlike a lot of people, he decided to take a stand. This brought all the issues finally out into the open. John Henry Falk was awarded $3.5 million, which was the biggest award settlement for a libel case up until that time. And this is what really effectively ended the blacklist.
Did it shame the networks and the advertisers into some backbone?
Now they didn't need any backbone. It's interesting, years later, there was a movie about that trial called Fear on Trial, based on John Henry Falk's memoir, and was broadcast by CBS, who was certainly involved in his blacklisting. There's only one network that's mentioned in this TV movie as being involved in the blacklist, and that's ABC.
David, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
David Everett's book is called A Shadow of Red, Communism and the Blacklist in Radio and Television. Yep, the 50s was a bad decade to be in showbiz in America. So bad that one entrepreneurial producer headed to England, where she became the driving force behind a show that became a blockbuster on American network TV. Sarah Fischko of WNYC, our producing station, has the story.
No, not Douglas Fairbanks Jr. as Robin in the 20s, or Errol Flynn in the 30s. The Robin Hood to remember was a 1950s TV series starring the handsome and dashing Richard Greene.
You caught this fellow stealing a deer?
Yes. We're just carrying out the punishment. We're royal foresters.
Playing our kind and indignant hero, always sticking up for the underdog.
You're going to do that to him just for killing a deer?
Robin Hood, riding through the glen.
It was the very first British produced series to be successful in American television.
Author Paul Buell.
And it was the first British show to have a song to go along with it that became an actual hit in the U.S. and in Europe, and that ends, feared by the bad, loved by the good, Robin Hood.
Robin Hood, Robin Hood, Robin Hood.
Buell's book with Dave Wagner, Hide in Plain Sight, fills in the remarkable backstory of the program, which began with a radical entrepreneur named Hannah Weinstein. Weinstein had for years worked on left-leaning projects and campaigns. But as red-baiting and blacklisting rose in the U.S. in that period, she felt she might be more comfortable, shall we say, elsewhere. And she went overseas to produce for TV.
She and people working with her invented very, very low-cost ways of producing television. And one of the ones best known in television lore is having this one bush on wheels that they moved from one part of the set to another.
In Weinstein's new London production company, Sapphire Films, they also used another clever strategy. They worked with a stable of American writers who'd been accused of being Communist Party members and sympathizers and had been blacklisted in the U.S. Hiring them served a double purpose. It yielded inexpensive, high-quality scripts, and Weinstein was also providing desperately needed work for the writers, who were now completely unemployable in their own country under their own names.
I was her story editor on Robin Hood.
Albert Rubin was a friend of the producer, hired for his trustworthiness, if not his expertise in television.
I knew virtually nothing. It was a really sink or swim situation.
The main writers for the series were big-time movie writers, people like Ring Lardner Jr., who'd written Woman of the Year, Waldo Salt, screenwriter of The Flame and the Arrow, and much later the writer of Midnight Cowboy, and Ian Hunter, with a list of Hollywood credits a mile long. Now they were churning out Robin Hood episodes in secret under assumed names.
There we are, Robin, on its way to the tax coffers of Prince John.
Two of her writers were Academy Award winners, which, of course, she never could have acquired for anything near the salary she paid unless they'd been on the blacklist.
Robin Hood was work they could get in the days when one TV season meant 39 episodes. Story editor Rubin was in England, and the writers were in America, because in addition to being unemployable, some had had their passports revoked. So a season of necessarily secret communications began. And communication was different in 1956.
It all had to be done by snail mail.
Rubin's job was to write lengthy story summaries and mail them to the writer.
They always signed their communication Will Scarlet and Friar Tuck. And so I wrote to them as such, WS and FT.
Everything was passed through a third party, of course, to avoid any identification.
And then we'd get back the scripts.
The scripts, not surprisingly, reflected the values of their writers. Years later, Ring Lardner Jr. noted that the series gave him plenty of opportunities for oblique social comment on issues and institutions of Eisenhower-era America. And so it went.
I came to die here, where they can't find my body, so Sir Charles can't collect his tax.
One episode has an unfair property tax placed on the poor serfs.
Properly speaking, a serf owns nothing except his stomach. But we enjoy generous customs in this manner.
And Robin and his men work to restore justice to the underclass.
I'd like to see his face when he hears he isn't going to get my ox.
In another, loyalties and allegiances are tested as the rulers try to infiltrate the band of outlaws.
We must convince them that Robin has only one reason for being an outlaw, his own personal profit.
And then try to force them to betray Robin.
So you thought you'd make fools of us with your play acting.
Sound familiar?
My men could give you lessons in that. They saw through you from the first.
There's even an episode about a witch hunt.
We saw her in the woods last night in Mab's garden. She met a demon there.
It looked like Satan himself. I think I saw his horns.
Robin has to save a village woman who would be burned at the stake for conspiring with the devil.
Bring her to trial, I say.
Sometimes the episodes went further afield.
This ship is bringing Jewish refugees who've lost their homes, and they're here to find new ones.
I would say one of the most intriguing episodes for me was the episode treating anti-Semitism, which basically is Robin Hood defending a merchant banker in York and his daughter against being dispossessed by royalty.
Surely, my lord sheriff, the idea of a whole shipload of these people coming here with their foreign and English ways is as intolerable to you as it is to every right-thinking person.
In the context of 1954, and the Rosenbergs, and so forth and so forth, pretty clear.
The Adventures of Robin Hood was an instant hit on both sides of the Atlantic. It ran for several seasons on CBS. And, of course, the more successful it became, the harder it was to conceal the identities of its band of merry blacklisted writers. Albert Rubin stood fast. Finally, after a long stretch, he was dispatched to New York for an important meeting with his writers. There they were, face to face, alias Friar Tuck, Will Scarlet, and the man who'd covered for them, their devoted story editor.
That was a big throw your arms around each other moment. It was an opportunity for us to do some laughing and raise a drink.
So here's to The Adventures of Robin Hood. You couldn't make this story up. A band of writers forced to be outlaws, writing in secret about a band of outlaws, with values and politics intact for 4 years in prime time. A bullseye you might say.
Robin Hood.
For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fishko.
Called the greatest archers to a tavern on the green. They vowed to help the people of the king. They handled all the trouble on the English country scene and still found plenty of time to sing.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Wolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Alex Goldman, with more help from Brett Jaspers and Michael Chaplin, and edited by me. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and engineering help from Dylan Keefe. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.